hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, lead it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the far that be. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fog that I keep. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be warning. And you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me.
Good evening, this is Paul Prom, and you're on the fighting side of me here at LightResistanceRadio.com with lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, you may not have heard of a man named Jagmeet Singh. Yeah, that's the guy's name. Not kidding you here. He's wearing a big old yellow turban. You know, any country that would consider a person like this for leadership is, well, pretty gone. But anyway, Jagmeet. Jagmeet is a provincial member of the Ontario legislature. And he's a Sikh, big beard and yellow turban. You know, that's okay back in the Punjab, but anyway, they all like to make these, fashion statements. Well, he's contesting the leadership of the New Democratic Party. That's Canada's Socialist Party. That's the federal party, actually. So he's Jagmeet, he's quite the ambitious type, and he's signed up some 47,000 members, they will then begin voting, I believe, sometime. I think it's in next May, although I could be wrong on that. But anyway, that's not really what the point's all about, except he's well, one strange-looking dude. So I think if are sometimes called the Dippers, that's the New Democratic Party, the NDP, sometimes called the Dippers, if the Dippers select him, They'll certainly be sending some sort of message. I'm not sure what, but about the direction they would like to see Canada go. I mean, I don't think this guy has any particular. I mean, he's a pushy, ambitious guy. Fair enough, but I don't think he has any particular insights as to how to lead the country, even the NDP. But anyway, that's not what the story's about. Story is a Canadian Press story. It says, heckler at NDP Jagmeet Singh event, an example of racism in Canada, professor says. A political science professor says a racist heckler, who interrupted a campaign rally for the NDP leadership hopeful Jagmeet Singh, is an example of the discrimination that deters minorities from politics. Well, that's a big gob of a opening sentence, and it's substantially false. How are minorities deterred from politics? Visible minorities have run for four major political parties, have been elected. We now have as our Minister of Defense another Sikh wearing a turban. In fact, Sikhs constitute about 0.97% of the Canadian population. In other words, less than 1%. There are four Sikhs in the federal cabinet. That means they've got about 16.5% in a 30-person cabinet of power. Now, how are they in any way deterred? Well, they're not. They're not. But this is just more abuse that guilt being heaped on Canadians. They're not being deterred. A video posted on YouTube of Singh's campaign event in Brampton earlier this week shows a woman interrupting his speech and accusing him of supporting Sharia law and the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I don't know what she based that on, and it's an opinion. Singh, who's a Sikh, responds to the woman saying he supports and loves her and that he won't be intimidated by her. Well, what's the hate there? Why not just say, if it's true, no, you're wrong, lady. This is where I stand. Now, on the other hand, if it is true, how's it hate? You know, that term has been used to cover up a lot of problems. I mean, sorry, a lot of ills. If the lady's wrong in her assertion, well, say it's wrong. That's what political debate's for. Aaron Tolley, a associate professor at the University of Toronto, said the incidents are a reminder that although Canada promotes multiculturalism, racist views are still prevalent. Well, wait a sec. If Singh does support Sharia law and Sharia law and the Muslim Brotherhood, that's not hate. It's not racism. Those accusations are a quick way to put an end to a discussion, and that, of course, that's really what they want to do. The professor, Aaron Tolley. I think one danger in Canada is we've become very congratulatory about our multiculturalism, but to some extent that conceals the number of Canadians who harbor racist sentiments. No, a whole lot of us don't agree with multiculturalism. We were never asked whether we wanted this. This was another imposition along with massive third world immigration. I don't agree with multiculturalism. Now, multiculturalism can mean two things. It can be a descriptor. That is, there are many cultures in Canada. To that extent, yes, regrettably, Canada is a multicultural country. Just like it would be true to say a good number of Canadians have cancer. That doesn't mean I'm in favor of it. That's just a descriptor. But no, our multiculturalism policy goes beyond that. We are told that multiculturalism, well, along with diversity, about the same thing, is our greatest strength. Let's not. It's by no possible stretch of the imagination are a strength. In fact, it's a weakness. You've got a divided population that doesn't share a lot in common. In fact, for many third world immigrants, Canada is simply a nice place to park their hat or their turban or whatever their headdress might be, collect welfare and Medicare. It's a nice place to be. I don't disagree with that, but they don't necessarily appreciate or affiliate with Canada's traditions. You've got to be able to kind of critique the professor's critique. Tolley said studies have shown about 30% of Canadians hold racist opinions, and while they might not all be vocal about their views, it does influence how they vote. Oh, isn't that terrible? You mean Canadians can't hold of course, what's a racist opinion? Well, a racist opinion, probably is any opinion critical of some privileged minority. So, I mean, this woman said, and I don't know if it's true or not, that Jagmeet Singh supports Sharia law. I don't know if he does, maybe he might. Or the Muslim Brotherhood. Again, I don't know. I mean, I'm not making that assertion on my own hook. I don't know what the woman had in mind. Nonetheless, she has a right to an opinion without her being labeled a racist. And that's part of the control mechanism. Anyway, back to the views of this Professor Aaron Tolley. In her research on race and politics, she said discrimination against minorities, gender, and people's sexual orientation can give them pause about whether they want to enter or continue in politics. Well, how's this discrimination? Not everybody's going to like you. Not everybody's going to like you if you're a Socialist Party candidate, or a Conservative Party candidate, or a Liberal Party candidate. That's what politics, or electoral politics, is all about. Yes, I mean, if you only want to be loved, and everybody thinks you're a sweet person, but it's probably not the right occupation to go into. Quote, this is Aaron Tolley, professor. I'm working on a study right now, talking to people who ran for the nomination of their party, and many candidates of color, which means non-whites, were somewhat surprised by what a negative experience it was, and so they are thinking of twice about whether they want to continue. Well, too bloody bad. There will be people, like myself, who don't like what's happened to our country, and all things being equal, I prefer to see somebody who looks like me be a candidate. And I'm not looking particularly for an LGBTQXYZ or a third worlder. I would like somebody who looks like me. That would be my preference. Would I vote for a non-white? Yes, I have. I wouldn't have. My preference would be in this direction. You mean we can't have these preferences, or if we do have preferences, it will deter them from running? Well, too bad. Too bad. You know, if they haven't got the stuff to be able to put up with the fact that there will be some people who don't like them. That's politics. That's human relations. So, Professor Aaron Tolley from the University of Toronto. And she goes on to say, Singh's ability to keep calm and respond in a positive manner to the heckler's evidence, is evidence that it wasn't the first time he experienced outwardly racist remarks. Well, the remarks weren't racist. The remarks had nothing to do with race. The remarks had something to do with radical politics. And the woman's accusation, and again, I say, I don't know if it's right or correct or not, but the accusation that Jagmeet Singh supported the Muslim Brotherhood and Sharia law. yet. And as I say, I don't know whether he does or not. And if he doesn't, well, then of course he's perfectly right to tell her you're wrong. But that's not racist. And, or is, are we getting to the point where it's to criticize a minority is to be racist? Anyway, having said all that, she says that Singh is also viewed as an inspiration to many people, which is reflected in the success he had in getting more people to join the party. That might be true, although I don't think so. The Sikhs are very clannish and well organized, and they can get a fair number of people, of their people, to troop out and join political parties on cue in order to gain power. And he would not be the first one to do that. But anyway, we'll leave that. Brad Salzberg is the head of a group in British Columbia. It's a small political party. And he is a strong opponent of third world immigration and of the attack on the two founding peoples of this country, the French and the English. And he has a particular target in mind with in the form of a columnist named Shri Paradkar. Now, Shri Paradkar writes for the Toronto Star, and he's a big white hater. Self-deception has repeatedly served as a bedrock of cruelty. It has transformed greed into gallant heroism, where invasion of lands is adventure, displacement of natives is about saving the savages, and theft and self-enrichment is ingenuity. Oh, okay. I kind of think he's talking about us. It has rationalized subjugation as the natural order of things. Women at home, gays in the closet, natives on reserves, and blacks in farms or in ghettos. And when there emerges an equal and opposite reaction, resistance that challenges the deception, it's met with denial. Brutal. Us. No, we saved you. And dismissal. You're not qualified to speak on this. And demand. Can't we just let the past, leave the past behind us and get along? And in this, this is Shri Paradkar. In this, I would include groups around the world that have utilized cruelty to enforce domination. Well, okay, hang on there, Shri, before you get too mixed up in your curry. All groups, all peoples around the world have conquered others and been conquered and done terrible things. So let's not go overboard here. White supremacy, I think I missed something here. White supremacy looks white supremacy looks like, minus the Charlottesville paraphernalia, Paradkar. Now, before we even get into the substance of his our nonsense, white supremacy is a misnomer for most of the protesters at Charlottesville some weeks ago. White supremacy means the desire to be supreme over all other people and to rule and to conquer them. Very few of the people who were at Charlottesville could be described as white supremacists. There were a lot of white nationalists. These are people who don't want their country, the overwhelmingly white and white-founded United States of America, overwhelmed by third world immigration. And I'm sick and tired of the ongoing favoritism for minorities, particularly blacks, involved in the so-called affirmative action programs. That's not white supremacy. Anyway, just be careful about that. Settler deception in Canada, however, is unique in the euphemisms it employs. A new painstaking research book debunks the myth of Canadian white benevolence and draws a straight line between past state-sanctioned injustices and current tensions. Oh my gosh, well, whose would that be? Well, there's this black feminist and activist writer, Robin Maynard, that's a female. There she is with ropes hanging out of her head. I think they're called dreadlocks. I mean, she looks like one proper freak. I mean, she really does. It's like shaved side of her head. And then, you know, flipped over and hanging long are these. They just look like hairy ropes. Okay. Her new book is Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada, From Slavery to the Present in Toronto. Okay, I kind of wonder, Robin, that's a female, not a male, Robin Maynard, whether when you talk about slavery in Canada, you actually get around to the people who really were slaveholders, and that was most of the native people, the Indians. They hold us, bull us, and enslaved one another, treating each other dreadfully. I'm just kind of wondering if that will make it into the book. Now, I haven't read the book yet, but I just sort of wonder. it would appear to be a book of just more shameless white bashing, which we become used to. But these people get published to bash away. Well, let's just see what old Paradkar has to say in promoting Robin Maynard's book. He says that Robin Maynard analyzes the work of dozens of scholars to pierce through the centuries of deception and offer a bold, unblinking, and frankly shocking rebuttal to the widespread sentiment that we're not as bad as the U.S. Well, actually, the U.S. isn't very bad either. The book weaves in indigenous experiences, that's Indians in case you're not up on the latest political correctees, and addresses how racial violence specifically impacted black women. It is written for academics and lay people alike. Racial violence impacted black women. What, whites are going around beating up negresses? I don't think so. Okay, well, one of the things, this is a quote from the book, one of the things that prompted me to write it is that working in black communities, growing up black in Canada, there was no history of anti-black racism that even I was not aware of for much of my life. Oh, okay, so didn't have much racism in her own life, or own life, I suspect, has been rather privileged and doted on by silly whites. And but anyway, later in life, she discovered she's a victim. You know, I keep urging people. Yeah, we've got to come back hard on these people, call their pretensions. Okay, now. People would experience anti-black racism, but it was so negated by non-black people around them. Their experience was seen as exaggerated or treated with disbelief. A lot of that disbelief stems from the broader disbelief that anti-black racism has been in place for 400 years. Right after the Revolutionary War, Canada welcomed a fair number of blacks who had fought on the side of the British in the Revolutionary War. Oh, is that racism? Anti-black racism? Canada also, rightly or wrongly, in the several decades before the War of Yankee Aggression, welcomed a fair number of escaped slaves in what was called the Underground Railway. Now, is that anti-black racism? She says that people would experience anti-black racism, but it was so negated by non-black people around them. What do you mean negated? In many cases, I think people quite rightly said, you're using so-called racism as an excuse for your own failures. You know, say something goes wrong in your life, what's racism? Well, it perhaps people don't like you because of the color of your skin, may also be because of you're just a screw up, or you're not that talented. One of my, I guess my second or third summer job, when I was in high school, I worked in a government office, and there was a Jamaican working there, and he was a constant whiner and bellyacher, complaining all the time that any setback he had at work was because he was black. In fact, I remember him whining once, "It's just because I'm black." This is back, about 1968 or 9. Well, it wasn't because he was black. This fellow was quite lazy and not a very good worker. And if he got reprimanded from time to time, it wasn't because he was black, it was because he was lazy. Anyway, this is more quotations from this book by Robin Maynard. Just as climatic unsuitability was long used to disguise the racist motivations behind demographic selections, Maynard writes, so was the desire to avoid the Negro problem that existed in the United States. Well, and very sensible too. We had a sensible immigration policy up till 1965. It was an immigration policy that strongly favored the British Isles and Europe. Duh! Well, why not? We were the founding settler people of the country. Wouldn't it make sense to bring in more like ourselves? Yes, of course it would. And let's see here. And we desire to avoid the Negro problem. Yes. Growing up in the 50s and 60s, I, like anybody else who was barely conscious, knew that the United States had a big racial problem. And there's nothing new about this. Going back a long, long time, people like Abraham Lincoln, not one I particularly admire or whatever, but Abraham Lincoln had said that the problem between the races was basically intractable. And he wanted, when the war between the states was over, or the war of Yankee aggression, as one might want to call it, that the Negroes would be sent back to Africa. He just didn't think the groups could get along. That was his opinion. And he's of course called the great emancipator. So yeah, America had a Negro problem, and Canada did not. And it was commonplace back in the 50s and 60s to say, well, we're lucky and we should avoid it. How will we avoid it? Well, we'll avoid it by not changing our immigration policy. I mean, why would we want to import a problem? Well, okay, common sense did not prevail. And we imported people from the from various from the third world, and what do we have today? Oh, a racial problem. It was totally predictable, and it was absolutely sensible. Why would we or any other country have import a racial problem? We knew it wouldn't be good. Okay, irony alert. Now, this is this anti-white column by what's his name? Sri Paradkar in the Toronto Star. Irony alert. Canadians believed the best way to keep racism out of the country was to keep black people out altogether. Absolutely. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Because it's not racism you're keeping it. It's racial conflict. People don't get along. For whatever reason, many blacks and others have been difficult to deal with. They want different things. They have come with a different culture, different expectations. I'd argue many come with different talent or lack of talent. Yeah, there's going to be problems. Well, why have it? Quote, it was in the interest of colored people themselves not to encourage their settlement in this country, meaning cites Dr. William D. Scott, a superintendent of immigration, from 1903 to 1924. In private correspondence, he doesn't hold back. Africans, no matter where they come from, are not among the races sought, he said. And that's up front, and I think that's quite right. Because up until relatively recently, it was almost universally agreed that the most sensible thing to do is to build a country of people from of similar backgrounds. You build a country of people like yourselves. It was only relatively recently that any substantial number of conspirators would even dare put forth the ridiculous proposition that diversity is our greatest strength. It was almost universally agreed that diversity wasn't going to be a good thing, and that wildly different people who are kind of bring with them incompatible and conflicting attitudes, religions, not going to be a good mix. This, although slavery was practiced in Canada for more than 200 years, well, actually, slavery in Canada has been probably practiced since time immemorial, almost entirely by Indians enslaving other Indians. This has got to be nonsense. This, from Sradkar, although 4,000 enslaved indigenous and black people helped build infrastructure and wealth for white settlers in the 17th and 18th centuries. Absolute nonsense. Now we're going to be told that it was Indian and black slaves who built the infrastructure in the 17th and 18th century, just like it was Chinese, that nobody would say they were slaves, but who built the railway in the 19th century. No, none of those is true. While the absence of plantations meant there were fewer enslaved black people, leaving them acutely isolated, white settler society here was not benign. It brutalized them physically and psychologically. Black women would be beaten, sexually abused, used for breeding, and have their children torn from them. This is, again, nonsense. The inferiority ascribed to blackness in this era would affect the treatment of black persons living in Canada for centuries to come. And Maynard also exposes the hollowness of the claim that Canada was a sanctuary for runaway slaves from the U.S. and for black loyalists. Well, it's true that Canada was. This is the face of structurally enforced impoverishment. It continues with segregation of schools, the last of which closed in Canada in 1983. Segregated black schools were underfunded and even abandoned by the government. Many children studied in dilapidated, unheated buildings. That was also true for white students in some poor areas as well. In the several parts of Canada where there were some blacks, in southwestern Ontario and around Halifax and Nova Scotia, there were segregated schools on the belief, as there was in the South, that people would learn better when they were with people like themselves. That's no longer the fashion, although the funny thing is, we now have segregated cries for, in fact, there are segregated black schools in Toronto, where they choose them because they want to be with fellow blacks. They will learn better, or so they say. Well, they want to revel in black culture. Segregation was bad back then, but now it's okay. And there was a separate graduating ceremony this year for University of Toronto black students. So segregation was wrong when whites did it, but segregation is right when current trendy blacks do it. It's nonsense. and she claims, oh, they're being persecuted today. the 2016 case of 6-year-old black grade 1 student in Mississauga school is in the book. The child was handcuffed by attaching her hands and feet together at the wrists and ankles for apparently acting in a violent manner. Apparently the kid was. Peel police deemed this containment necessary in the interest of safety of the child, who was considered that dangerous even in the presence of school officials and policemen. Oh, she calls this state-sanctioned racial violence. No, she wasn't handcuffed because she was black. She was handcuffed because she was violent. Supremacist values were foundational for the creation of white wealth. Oh, I see. This does not mean all whites are white supremacists, but it does mean all. Nor does it mean all whites are wealthy. Okay, we're wealthy, or some whites are wealthy, because of white supremacy. If it makes some whites wealthy, why doesn't it make all whites wealthy? This book is a crock of nonsense, but it gets reviewed and so on. Well, this is Paul Fromman. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to take a short musical interlude here, and why don't we play a song by a very, very attractive lady. Goes back to the late 80s. Blonde late girl from Minnesota, Paulette Carlson. She was the original lead singer for a very successful late 80s, early 90s group called Highway 101. This is Paulette, and Just Say Yes. Thank you. Carlson, Highway 101, Just Say Yes. Play another, tune that I hope you'll like. I was looking for her Paulette's most recent, but you'll probably play that another night. And then this is one I think you'll like as well. We're having a little bit of trouble getting this here. Yes, this is Patti Loveless, girl from Pikeville, Kentucky, and this is Blame It On Your Line.
Find exactly what you weren't looking for. Home Sense. Endless possibilities, perfectly priced.
Play one more tune for our musical interlude tonight, and wonder why we've got the problems with this screen. I'm telling you sometimes. I think we just heard that, and I'm sure, good as it was, you'd like to hear a different tune. And this is by another one of the big stars of country and western music some years ago, and this is Lori Morgan, and this is What Part of No Don't You Understand? Lori Morgan, What Part of No Don't You Understand? And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I have a very interesting story. I've actually heard some of this from a good political friend of mine who told me about her son-in-law. And I want us to thank Arden Gifford down in Houston for passing this on to me. Southern Men, it's called. Hundreds and hundreds of small boats pulled by countless pickups and SUVs from across the South headed for Houston. Almost all of them were driven by men. They were using their own property, sacrificing their own time, spending their own money, and risking their own lives for one reason: to help total strangers in desperate need. Most of them are by themselves. Most are dressed like redneck duck hunters and bass fishermen. They are. In fact, I know two who went down together, a man and his brother-in-law. Most are veterans. Most are wearing well-used gimme hats, t-shirts, and jeans. And there's a preponderance of camo. Most are camouflage. Most of them are probably gun owners, and most probably voted for Trump. These are the people the left loves to hate, the ones Maddow mocks, the ones Maher and Olbermann just know they're so much better than. These are the quiet ones. They don't wear masks and tear down statues. They don't, as a rule, march and demonstrate, and most are probably never been in a Whole Foods. But they'll spend the next, they spend several days waiting in cold, dirty water, dodging gators and water moccasins and fire ants, eating whatever meager rations were available, and sleeping wherever they could in dirty, damp clothes. Their reward is the tears and the hugs and the smiles from the terrified people that they helped. They'll deliver one boatload and then go back for more. When disaster strikes, it's what real men do. Real men. Heroic men. American men. And then they'll knock back a few shots or a few beers with like-minded men they've never met before and talk about fish or 10-point bucks or the benefit of hollow point ammo or their F-150. And the next time they hear someone talk about the patriarchy or male privilege, they'll snort, turn off the TV, and go to bed. In the meantime, they'll likely be up again before dawn to do it again, until the helpless are rescued and the work's done. They're unlikely to be reimbursed, they won't get medals, they won't care, they're heroes, and it's what heroes do. Very, very powerful, I think, little thought piece, and very true, very accurate. This is what happened. And so much of what happened with the terrible flooding, Hurricane Harvey in Houston, due to the bravery of volunteer white men, you know, this is something that I think you know, we should put about as much as possible. Well, $168,000 for asking four-year-olds about their internal sense of gender identity. Talk about government out of control. I want to thank LaVon in Calgary, Alberta, for sending this my way. The feds spend $138,000 asking four-year-olds about their internal sense of gender identity. The National Science Foundation, this is a U.S., not Canadian, sorry, National Science Foundation is spending over $130,000 on a study that asked four-year-olds about their internal sense of gender identity. A grant for a two-year study was awarded to the University of Washington this past summer. The project will interview 250 children aged 4 to 6 and their parents, asking a series of questions about gendered behavior. Prominent theories of gender development have discussed the degree to which gender identity results from an internal sense of gender and socialization processes, according to the grant. However, tests of these theories have been limited because for most children, internal gender identity and environmental socialization substantially overlap, rendering it impossible to distinguish the relative impact of each factor on gender development. To put a lot of academic gobbledygook a little more in plainer English, they're having trouble figuring out whether it's socialization or what the children feel inside. Well, for most people, it overlaps. The little boy is a little boy. His little body is different from a little girl, and society treats them that way. No mystery here. What do we have to study? The study will investigate whether gender theory, such as the gender schema theory that blames society on differences between the genders, are sufficient for today's wider range of human gender experiences, where there can be anywhere from between 3, 37, or 58 genders, depending on who. It's really the trip into the world of madness. Among the study's questions asked of preschoolers include what gender toys they play with. The project will involve 254 to 6-year-olds and their parents to complete a battery of measurements, etc., etc., etc. I guess probably most of the little boys play with little boy toys, you know, baseball bats and hockey sticks, I don't know, depending where it is, and trucks and planes and so on, and the little girls play with dolls and things. And no big surprise here. Christina Olson and Celine Gulgosh Two researchers at the university are leading the study. Both are involved, oh, watch this, both are involved with the school's Trans Youth Project, a longitudinal study of gender development and mental health of transgender kids. I wonder if they're not going to, well, you can almost sense that this may be biased. The Transgender Youth Project was featured in Katie Couric's documentary for National Geographic called The Gender Revolution. Our current research study is recruiting children aged 3 to 12 who are transgendered, gender nonconforming, and siblings of gender nonconforming children. The website of the project states, well, I think you can pretty much be sure this is going to be a skewed study and an utter waste of American taxpayers' money. 3 to 12-year-olds who are transgendered, it can't be. We're talking about nonsense here. Or gender nonconforming. That is, looks like a little boy, but sometimes acts like a little girl. Oh, yes, okay. And siblings of the gender nonconforming. So, another academic unbalanced study, which will probably come up with, you guessed it, you know, it's all persecution and it's all our fault. You know, don't have to pay them, spend $130,000 to learn that. It's a foregone conclusion. This is Paul Froman. You've been on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.